Oyez, oyez, oyez.
All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 05-3100, United States of America versus Anthony D. Anderson, appellant. Ms. Wright for appellant, Ms. Dickey for appellee.
Good morning. May it please the court, Lisa Wright representing Anthony Anderson. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Anderson seeks an evidentiary hearing on his ineffective assistance of counsel claim, and if that hearing does not lead to a new trial, a resentencing. We have shown a clear deficiency by counsel on this record under Strickland, where counsel failed to appreciate Mr. Anderson's obvious ACCA exposure. Government does not challenge our deficiency allegation. We need only show a colorable allegation, and it's clear from this record that we've shown much more than that. Counsel originally agreed there was a 15-year minimum that applied, then inexplicably brought Mr. Anderson in to plead, telling the court there was a 77 to 96 month range. When challenged, he asserted that most of Mr. Anderson's many ACCA-able priors were stale, when in fact there is no such thing as staleness for ACCA purposes, and the district court recognized that almost immediately.
Well, since the government doesn't challenge your claim of deficiency, isn't the question for you really whether there's prejudice as a result?
Yes, and I will move to prejudice.
Before you get to, I just want to be the deficiency of counsel, the ineffective representation, was the failure to advise the defendant of the accurate ranges that he was exposed to, number one, by pleading guilty, and number two, by going to trial. Is that what it was?
Failing to understand, yes, the 15-year mandatory.
But before he went to trial, the court advised him of those ranges, right?
Before he went to...
Before the trial started, before any testimony was taken, before any witness was called, the court gave the defendant the ranges. Do you realize, the court said, that if you go to trial, the range is whatever it is, and then if you plead, the range is such and so, 15-year minimum, the court said. And do you still want to go to trial? And the defendant says yes.
Right.
So he's got the proper advice. I know the government didn't argue this. I'm baffled. I mean, absolutely stunned by the government's failure to say, look, whatever deficiency the attorney is guilty of, the court corrected it.
Well, by that time, though, the damage was done, because he had entered his aborted plea. That the statements Your Honor is referring to were after that, after he had already made those statements, which was
the court gave your client, the defendant, the opportunity to plead guilty rather than go to trial before the trial started, right, after he was advised of the correct sentencing guideline ranges.
Right. He doesn't want to plead guilty, though. He wants to go to trial and testify. That's his claim, is that he...
Well, that's a different... See, that's why I asked you, what is the deficiency? Is it the failure to advise of the sentencing guideline range correctly, or is it something else, the something with the perjury?
There was two deficiencies. The one that's clear on the record, and one that gets us, we believe, into the prejudice analysis, is that he caused him to make clearly these statements in the aborted plea that he had said early on. Your Honor is exactly right. If it's a 15-year penalty, he had said at a status hearing he wanted to go to trial. So then he comes in and he hears, no, it's going to be less, and he says, now I want to plead guilty. That gets us into the prejudice analysis. There is then another deficiency that we believe we can show on remand at the hearing that proves our prejudice from the first deficiency. It's a little, there's a few steps to it, but essentially he, by misadvising him on the gun exposure, he makes these statements, which then he is misadvised on the perjury exposure, which causes him not to take the stand, and he makes an unintelligent waiver.
If he changed his, if he took the stand and changed what he said at the plea hearing, he would be subjected to perjury. Isn't that a perjury prosecution? What's deficient about that advice?
Because he wouldn't have, what he would have said at trial was actually not inconsistent with what he said at the plea. his counsel, if his counsel had realized that, he would have advised him, you don't have perjury exposure, you have minimal perjury exposure. And he also told him, we believe we can show that he told him it was a 15-year exposure as opposed to 5, so that he was gaining nothing, essentially, by testifying, even if he was acquitted. But all he admitted at the plea was that he knew the gun was under the seat and that he, quote, put it there. His testimony at trial was actually not going to be inconsistent with that, and counsel knew it. Counsel at sentencing asserts that the gun was thrown at him and that he kicked it under the seat. So that's the prejudice we're arguing, is that he would have testified if he hadn't made this aborted plea. And the prosecutor was warning counsel that he might not even be able to ethically put on the testimony. The court was also concerned and said, counsel, be sure and warn him that if there's a perjury prosecution, you have to warn him that these statements could be used. And counsel, unfortunately, failed to realize that there really was.
So your theory is that the testimony, or the sworn statements that he made during the plea colloquy, are not inconsistent with this new story the story that he would have told had he taken the stand?
That's correct. Right, yeah. That there certainly.
And how do we know what he would have said?
Well, we know
had he taken the stand?
We know what he said at sentencing, and we know what he said at the plea. He did talk a little bit about what occurred at the plea.
Oh, I wanted to ask you one thing, and I know I've interrupted your sequence, but the defendant was on parole when he was stopped.
That appears to be correct.
How much time left on the parole?
I would have to check that.
That's rather significant, isn't it?
I think, you know, it depends how much time people end up getting there, then re-paroled often. I don't think it's easy to predict how much time he would get for that.
For a violation of parole?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think.
Well, the reason I ask is because the defendant says, well, you know, I was ready to take the rap for my son-in-law-to-be, and I figured it would only be 3 years, you know, for gun possession or something to that effect.
Criminal defendants are notoriously optimistic, I will say.
Well, yeah, but if I believe that story, then I have a problem, and the problem is that this guy was violating parole too. So it wasn't just a gun charge that he was facing; he was also facing the time for a parole violation. So it's hard for me to see the truth in that story.
Well, there may have been some extra time there, but his point was, and I think he explained it rather credibly at the sentencing, that, you know, he spent most of his life in prison already. He was not a young man like the daughter's boyfriend. He had never done anything for his daughter. And I think if you look at what he's saying, it actually makes some sense. He thinks he's going to give up a few years of his life, but his daughter, he will have finally done something for her, as opposed to basically giving up, you know, in his view, almost the rest of his life. It's a different outcome. And clearly,
it's really great. I mean, he's doing his daughter a favor by allowing her to get married to a guy who's carrying a gun and possesses cocaine. I mean,
that's a whole other matter. Yeah. But it's his daughter's view that I think he's concerned about, probably. But, I mean, we do know that he did not want to plead guilty when it was 15 years, and he was willing to plead to 77 to 96 months. So I think that at a hearing we will be able to show that there was this additional deficiency with the perjury exposure, and he just was unable to make a knowing waiver of his right to get on the stand and tell the jury. And we also think that if the jury had heard his version of events on this record, that it's extremely likely, not just reasonably probable, that he would have been acquitted, because the jury, as it was, had no alternative theory in front of them. And in fact, the lay witness, Ms. Hearn, her testimony would in fact have corroborated his timeline and contradicted the police timeline. And those contradictions maybe didn't appear as important to the jury when they didn't understand what Mr. Anderson's version of what occurred was, and indeed her testimony supported that.
Can I ask you about the sentencing claim?
Yes.
Because Rita is actually decided after your case, I think.
Correct.
So doesn't that mean that the law was not settled?
Well, I think the statute itself made clear that the standard, the parsimony provision, was in place, and it was quoted in Booker. So it's our view that it was plain that the question was, what is the sentence that's sufficient but not greater than necessary? and that the guidelines were one of many factors. It's listed, I think it's A4 under 3553. And it's not a situation where, in order to even consider, which is what the court said, going below the guidelines, she needed some reason, that those factors were all equal factors there, and with the parsimony provision, that her duty was to find the sentence sufficient and not greater than necessary. It's true the government was arguing at that time that there was sort of a presumption of reasonableness in the district court. The fact that they were arguing it, I don't think means it wasn't obviously wrong. And I think Rita confirms that. The fact that Rita hadn't been decided yet doesn't make it less plain at the time. It's our view. If there's no other questions, I think my time is expiring. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Lauren Dickey. I represent the appellee, the United States, in this matter. Before moving to the specific issues addressed in the briefs, I'd like to address Judge Randolph's first question to Ms. Wright about the government's, or not question, but comment about the government's a decision not to address the deficiency of defense counsel in this case. The reason for that was that the government is not conceding deficiency. The government does believe in this case, though, that a hearing on the deficiency, if it came to that, would be necessary based on the representations of appellant's counsel that the defense counsel did give information to appellant that was incorrect about perjury, and that if appellant relied on that incorrect information about his perjury consequences for testifying, that then there would have been a deficiency. So the government... yes, Your Honor.
I may have missed that. The government is not conceding that the defense counsel gave the defendant incorrect advice about possible perjury prosecution? Is that what you just said?
I don't know that that's exactly what I said. What I meant was that the record does not show either way what advice was given to appellant about his perjury culpability or liability. Merely all we know is that appellant's counsel has represented that advice was given and that it was incorrect, and that based on that advice, appellant chose not to testify. Thus, the government's position is a hearing would be necessary to determine that issue if this court were to determine that the second prong of Strickland, if the government hadn't succeeded on that part of its argument, that there would need to be a hearing on the deficiency side of the matter.
So the perjury advice is that representation comes solely from the appellate counsel for the defendant? That's the only information we have regarding that?
Yes, Your Honor. That's my understanding. Moving.
But do you concede that, or do you agree that the defendant would not have been subjected to a perjury prosecution, a possibility of a perjury prosecution?
He said
he agreed with the government's version of the events. He answered yes.
Yes, Your Honor.
And he would take the stand and say, no, I don't agree.
Your Honor, I think the reason a hearing would be necessary would be to flush that out. He says yes at the beginning, but then when asked specific questions, he gives his own version of events. An appellant may have just responded yes because he was, as appellant's counsel suggests, taking responsibility and helping out his daughter at this time. But when asked specific questions about the event, he gives a different version. So the government, having not knowing enough about what advice was given and not knowing enough about and needing to hear more about appellant's testimony on that point, the government chose to push that for a hearing and not deal with it in its brief for purposes of this.
Does your brief say if you lose on the prejudice prong that you would assume you get a remand on the deficiency prong?
And I don't know that the brief says that specifically.
Well, but I mean, for appellate purposes, you've essentially abandoned any argument on the deficiency prong. So I don't understand your whole argument that we would expect to get a hearing. We're at the appellate court now. You chose not to contest their contention on deficiency and focus solely on prejudice, which means you've given up any argument on deficiency. I don't know how you now stand here and say, well, if we lose on prejudice, we would expect to go back. Where does that come from?
Well, Your Honor, the appellant was seeking under Rashad a remand for a hearing in the district court on this issue. That is what they're before the court here today. The government's position is that a remand is not necessary because they haven't satisfied the prejudice prong.
I understand. Right. My understanding is that's all that's before us on that. That's all. You decide how you want to package your case. That's all. If you lose that, Strickland's gone. You've lost it.
Correct. If we've lost the prejudice prong based on what we've put forth, a hearing would be required, is the government's position. Because
we're talking past each other.
I apologize, Your Honor.
If you lose the prejudice prong, you've lost your Strickland argument.
I wouldn't agree with that. I think.
Well, you have to frame up a case on appellate review to preserve your claims. You can't say, oh, well, wait, now that I hear Judge Randolph's questions, we want to make it clear, should we lose prejudice, we should get a hearing on deficiency. I don't understand that.
Well, the issue before the court was whether a hearing was necessary, and the government.
And the test for that, articulate the test for that. That's the key. What's the test for whether a hearing is necessary? And we're a minority of one circuit. All the other circuits that I haven't checked recently, but all the other circuits don't go through this stuff that we go through on appeal. But the test is, unless it clearly appears that the defendant would lose on an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, the case goes back for a hearing. So the only question before us is whether he would clearly lose.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Right. Okay.
And our position with respect to that is that the appellant is not entitled for a remand hearing, because the record conclusively shows that even if appellant had testified and the jury had credited his testimony, there's no reasonable probability that a jury who was following the law and abiding by the district court's instructions would have acquitted appellant. Now, the government recognizes that a jury may have been sympathetic to the facts that appellant's testimony would have put forth, or may have found it unfair that they would have to convict someone, find someone guilty for the short possession that the appellant had. However, if the jury were to acquit on that basis, on a basis of sympathy or feeling like this was unfair, the government's position is that would be jury nullification, that the jury wouldn't be following the law and the instructions of the district court, and as a result, that is their defense. It's a nullification defense. And Strickland does not allow ineffective assistance claims that are based on a jury nullification or non-legal defense. Specifically, upon hearing the appellant's testimony, assuming the appellant's testimony is consistent with the record, which Ms. Wright said that it would be, the jurors would have concluded that the appellant kicked the gun underneath the seat of the vehicle to hide the gun from the police and to protect his daughter's fiance, who was the passenger of the vehicle. And the affirmative act of hiding the gun and doing so either to protect himself or his daughter's fiance would be constructive possession under the law. It would demonstrate an ability to exercise knowing dominion and control over the items in question. Now, a jury may acquit based on feeling sympathetic to the appellant, but that wouldn't be a legal basis for acquitting. And as Strickland says, the appellant can't seek a hearing because he has a sympathetic testimony that may get him an acquittal.
Well, how do you read there are a couple of cases on this. How do you read the law, our case law, with respect to a situation like this, where a person, assuming his story is correct, gun gets pushed over to him, to avoid constructive possession, what? You have to kick it back or immediately say to the police, you know, there's a gun under it, it's not mine. I want you to know that right out. Is that it?
Well, I think
one of those two things, if you kicked it back.
I apologize, continue, Your
Honor. No, that's all right. If he kicked it back.
Your Honor, I think that there are several things he could have done. One, he could have just told the police, there's a gun here, it's not mine. He could have not touched it at all.
He would be forever unloved by his daughter.
Allegedly. or he could have just not done anything to it, not touched it. According to appellant, he affirmatively kicked it under the seat, and his testimony in several places is he kicked it up under the seat to really hide.
So you say if he just didn't do anything, he could avoid constructive possession?
Yes, because his argument could be, I knew it was there, it was close to me, but mere presence isn't enough, and I haven't touched it, and I haven't done anything to show an intent to control it or possess it. By kicking it, and specifically kicking it under the seat, appellant has shown an intent and ability to control the firearm, which under the law is constructive possession. I see I only have a minute left, so I'd like to move to the second issue, the sentencing issue. The district court did not plainly err in sentencing appellant to a guideline sentence of 235 months, which was the lowest end of the guideline range in this case, because the district court's analysis was proper under Booker and Rita, and the district court's off-the-cuff comment at the end of the sentencing was not obvious error, as it reasonably could have been interpreted to mean that the district court just wasn't crediting appellant's version of events. Moreover, even if appellant could demonstrate that the district court plainly erred, the district court's sentencing procedures and the statements at the end of the sentencing transcript do not show that the district court would have changed their sentence or done anything different if appellant had been allowed to, I guess, testify further or had the district court employed different procedures. And at this, I see my time's almost up. Are there any questions on the sentencing?
Well, I do wonder. You kind of say we could speculate about what the court meant and that it meant that it did consider these things, but doesn't that mean we could also speculate that the court felt it was constrained?
Well, I would have two answers to that. The first is, if you read the sentencing transcript as a whole and look at all the statements that the district court made, which many of the cases suggest the courts need to do in order to determine sort of the effect of the procedures and what the district court was doing, you'll see that the district court first looked at the guidelines and determined that the guidelines were appropriate in this case because appellant had a long history of criminal conduct. And she said that the armed criminal, career criminal statutes and the guidelines that go with them are meant for people like him. So first she makes that determination and creates a starting point as the guidelines are appropriate here for this appellant. And then she moves on and looks at all the factors and the 3553 factors and looks at his age and his background, history, family issues, substance abuse, and determines that there's just nothing in his life that would motivate her or suggest to her that she should be outside the guideline range that she had already found to be appropriate as to appellant. But even stating that, or even if finding an error in that procedure, the government's position is that a remand wouldn't change anything. The district court's low-end sentence was based on predominantly the appellant's criminal history. She focuses on that all the time, talks about all the different crimes he's committed, the fact that he is unable to stay out of trouble his whole life, and that is really the driving force of her sentence. And because of that, sending it back so that the district court could look at it again to make proper procedures under Rita or to, credit or look at the appellant's testimony and his version of events would not change it, especially looking at the fact that the district court already imposed a low-end guideline sentence of 235 months.
What about if we believe the district court really did fail to consider his allocution?
Again, Your Honor, since we're under the plain error standard, the test would be, even if it was an error that she failed to listen to his version of events, that in order to remand it, this court would have to find that she would change, there's a substantial chance that she would change her sentence based on hearing the testimony. And based on the fact that she found the guidelines to be appropriate to appellant because of his criminal history, and then she sentenced him to the very lowest end, there's no likelihood or reasonable likelihood that the outcome would change if the district court were to hear or to listen to appellant's version of events.
Thank you.
May I ask you, this case, the events and the, well, did the trial take place in 2005 in this case?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe.
Why did it take so long?
I'm sorry, 2004.
Why did it take so long for this case to get to us?
That was an interesting question that we looked into, and the only thing the government was able to see is that the appellant changed counsel several times and that there were issues with getting the transcripts. And that's all that the government was able to learn of why it took so long.
Okay, thanks.
Ms. Wright, I think you had no time left. Well, we'll give you 2 minutes.
Thank you. I just want to say quickly, we do know that his decision not to testify was not driven by the typical factor of fear of impeachment with the priors. We have sort of an unusual record in that he essentially just affirmatively declined the district court's repeated offer to tell him if he could be impeached with those priors. So really, there's very little other explanation for why he wouldn't have wanted to tell his story, since he tried to tell it both at the plea and at the sentencing. And it was a pretty compelling rebuttal to the police testimony and corroborated by Ms. Hearn. The government suggests that our defense is one of sympathy or unfairness or nullification, and that's not the case. The jury needs to find intent to possess. And if he is kicking the gun away in order to distance himself from the incorrect impression that he's in possession, he's trapped in a car. It's not as if he can simply walk away like you could if you saw a gun on the street or you were near someone that had a gun and you could walk away.
If he had kicked it away, you would have had an interesting claim. The problem is his own story is that he kicked it within his compass to hide it.
Well, I don't know that he said to hide it. And also,
well, if he wasn't intending to hide it, he didn't have to kick it.
Well, I would say it's certainly safer to have it under your own seat than to have it in someone else's arm reach. I mean, if he'd sent it back to the guy, he's essentially facilitating his possession. This way, he's securing it.
It was his possession. He's according to his story, he's now willing to join it to protect him.
Well, I think what we said in our reply is he was trying to protect himself at that point.
It was by hiding it, sure. I mean, he could have had possession by just keeping it close to him and hoping the police didn't see it. But once he decided to retain possession, he wanted to hide it.
Well, I think it turns.
I mean, that's the problem with the story.
But it turns on his intent, and his intent, I think, was to eliminate this false impression, not to take true possession of it. And I mean, I gave this example in the brief about, you know, kicking, I think, drug paraphernalia under your porch or something like that if you find it in your yard, and you know, ironically, a similar thing, you know, about a month ago occurred to me, and I carried it into my house and put it in my trash can, and I could actually see little residue even inside a bag.
Have you gotten notice of the charges yet?
Well, that's what I'm saying. I find it hard to believe that I was in possession of drugs or drug paraphernalia. And I think it's a pretty analogous situation. And I think it turns on what he would say and whether the jury would credit him. If I could just say one thing about the sentencing...
Before you get to that.
Yes.
Do you know whether the co-defendant went to trial? Or pled guilty?
No, the co-defendant, the charges were dropped immediately. He didn't pursue.
No charges against the co-defendant, or not the co-defendant, the guy in the car. Right.
Was arrested at the same time, the passenger.
Right.
Right. He was no papered, I guess is the term. He was never, not even sure he had an initial appearance.
And I'd like your evaluation about whether this is correct, that in order that if the defendant had taken the stand and given the story that we're now given about the, you know, it wasn't his gun and all that, wouldn't the jury have to disbelieve the police?
I think they would have to disbelieve.
They'd have to believe it.
No, they wouldn't have to disbelieve. I'm going to take that back. They would have to have a reasonable doubt. They would have to have a reasonable doubt about
the
officer.
Credit his testimony over the police's, you know, that or it would establish it beyond a reasonable doubt.
I hesitate to say credit over because really the Red Book has taken away any notion of truth finding or true finding out where the truth lies. What the jury just has to do is decide if the defendant's testimony creates a reasonable doubt about the possession.
Yeah.
And really that doesn't necessarily mean that they disbelieve the police. They could just be, they're just not sure, they don't know. On the sentencing, if I could just quickly say that I think it is very plain error not to consider allocution of a defendant. That's well-established law. And that the sentencing as a whole does show that the court didn't understand her Booker authority. The counsel talked about the criminal record and how the court was so concerned about, but as defense counsel argued, that was his bad record was very much accounted for by the fact that he'd gone from a 10-year statutory maximum to a 15-year minimum, and that it's also important that the court, at one point, probation, even after everything had occurred and all the misunderstandings about his sentencing exposure, probation said he had 100 to 125 months. The government signed off on that. So they're satisfied with that on some level, and then the court gives him almost 20 years when it could have given him 15. I think there's a very strong inference the court did not understand the authority at that time of confused law. Thank you.
We understand your argument. Thank you.